Welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you by our producer, IEJ Media, and our sponsor, Bauer Group Asia. We'll talk about them more a little bit later. I'm Ray Powell, the former military officer. That's Jim Caruso, the former diplomat. Jim, it is Liberation Day plus a couple. How you feeling?
Less liberated than I'd hoped. Well, mostly liberated for my money. Yeah, it's interesting.
All right. Well, maybe our guest can help liberate us.
We have a return victim, Chris Johnstone. Last time we saw Chris, he was at the Center for Strategic International Studies as Japan chair. He is now graduated to the private sector as a partner in national security, still doing Japan, I presume, at the Asia Group. Chris, welcome back.
Great to be here, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
As we discussed, there's sort of a lot going on. You've been recently in Japan. You're still covering Japan. I guess the question of the moment is, should Americans care how Japan reacts to the tariffs and to the peak Defense Secretary Hegseth visit that just occurred earlier this week?
Of course, Americans should care how Japan responds. Japan still has the third largest economy in the world, easily our most important ally and partner in the Indo-Pacific, huge foreign investor in the United States, automobile sector in particular, but also all kinds of other areas, technology, consumer electronics, et cetera. So Japan's a consequential player. They've been, sort of polite and relatively restrained in response to what's happened over the last few days. But this is, as it is for many of our friends, right, a major political challenge for one of America's closest friends, how to respond to this, how to preserve a constructive relationship with the United States while also protecting the Japanese economy. Some of the estimates I've seen suggest that if these tariffs that have been announced, I mean, we'll see what's actually implemented and how long they're maintained. But if they are, that it could shave more than a half of a percentage point off of Japanese GDP growth over the next year. That's a lot. An economy growing 2% a year, between 1% and 2% a year, losing a half a point is a lot. So this is a significant thing for our Japanese friends.
So, Chris, it doesn't seem very long ago that I think it was 2019 that the U.S. concluded a phase one trade deal with Japan under, hang on, let me check my notes. Oh, the Trump administration. What is the effect on U.S.-Japan relations from going from a phase one trade deal that liberalizes trade to all of a sudden sort of snapping into this very restrictionist policy?
Yeah, and I think it was actually the existence of that phase one trade agreement that led many Japanese officials to think that they might be insulated from some of these measures that the Trump administration has said it would pursue. So I think it was, I know it was a shock that that in fact, the Trump administration went ahead with these announcements. Look, I think, and I don't think the Japanese are alone in this. I think they're trying to reconcile what they see as two pretty different messages from the administration. On the one hand, right, we now have two data points, senior level engagements between the two governments. Ishiba's visit to the White House in February 7th, I believe, and then Secretary Hegseth's, the defense secretary's visit to Tokyo just last week, both of which were very positive and concluded with announcements of a lot of continuity in the U.S.-Japan alliance agenda, in the regional agenda, and the bilateral agenda. So on the one hand, you have that, those two big data points, and then you have these actions that have happened subsequently. So I think there's, like many of our partners, a real sense of uncertainty about how these things come together and what is really going to be the main pillar of the administration's approach. It's a time of real confusion, I think, for Japanese friends and others.
Well, I know I'm confused because on the one hand, we want Japan to increase their defense spending, but we're taking away some of their ability to grow economically and afford that spending, which would include buying a whole bunch of kit from the United States. So I guess the question is, if you were advising the Japanese government on how to navigate this, what would you tell them to do?
Yeah. So this is exactly the dilemma, Jim. You know, how do you, on the one hand, ask the Japanese to buy more, and then on the other hand, slap tariffs and other sort of more punitive measures upon them? I think any attempt to sort of construct coherence around all this is pretty challenging right now. But look, I think there's not an easy answer to the question. I think what the Japanese are going to do is, number one, they will look for ways to demonstrate their commitment to the United States, in some ways look for increased purchases from the United States. Ishiba floated a couple of ideas, for example, when he was in the Oval Office. The defense minister made it clear that Japan wants to purchase, for example, more missiles and other defense equipment from the United States. There's actually a frustration on the Japanese side with the timelines for the delivery of those systems, but there is an attempt to signal demand. But I also think you're going to see from the Japanese and from others as well, you're already seeing this in Europe, an effort to strengthen their own industry and to continue to invest in indigenous capability. That was already happening. It was a big focus of their 2022 national defense strategy, an effort to strengthen Japan's domestic industry. They're going to double down on that. And I think you will also see efforts to reach out to other potential industry partners. I mean, the defense world, for example, it's quite interesting to look at Japan's cooperation with the UK, BAE, on this new fighter aircraft, some other areas that we see. So I think there's going to be a mix of looking for opportunities that make sense for Japan to purchase more, but also a focus on indigenous production and then non-US partners. I think you'll see a mix of all three.
Yeah. Now, Chris, I'm a knuckle-dragging military officer. I don't know anything about these things, but I can read a stock market chart. And when I see the squiggly line for the last couple of days on the Nikkei, it's going down a lot, something like almost 10%. What is going to be the effect of these tariffs on just Japan's domestic economy and the government's ability to consider some of these, you know, these initiatives that they're considering?
Yeah. So this is I think, a really critical point. So as I suggested earlier, if implemented and if sustained, the economic impact is significant, right? I mean, already when they were talking, when the Trump administration announced auto sector tariffs, in other words, just on that sector alone, the impact was going to be profound. Some economists were saying as much as a quarter of a percentage point just from the auto sector alone, impact on GDP growth. Japan manufactures, I think it's something like 60% of its automobiles that it sells in the United States. 60% are made in the United States, but that means 40% are made in Japan, and a lot of parts are made in Japan. So profound impact on the Japanese economy, and so therefore the impact is also potentially quite significant politically, right? I mean, Prime Minister Ishiba was already on somewhat shaky ground. Heads a minority government as it is, approval ratings under 40%, looking at two significant elections this summer, the Tokyo Metropolitan election, which is a big one in Japan, given the size of Tokyo, and then an upper house election. And the odds were already sort of barely even that he would survive those, depending on how the LDP does. So it's quite possible that this set of events will precipitate political change in Japan as well at the leadership level. Now, there is no debate. We don't see in Japan the debates that we see playing out in parts of Europe about future of a relationship with the United States, you know, more autonomy from the United States, some similar sorts of rhetoric, right, from Canada. We don't see those kinds of forces, but they could easily begin to appear. And as I said, you're going to begin to see things in kind of less explicit ways in policy, more focus on domestic industry, more focus on finding other partners, diversifying Japan's economic and political relationships. Those sorts of things will gain momentum if these measures are implemented and sustained. And I do think that's an important if. We don't really know whether the purpose of these tariffs is negotiation or actually revenue raising and the other things that the president has talked about. And which way we come down on those, I think, is going to have a lot of impact on our friends and neighbors.
I guess my concern about the negotiation possibility is, how do you negotiate with all these countries simultaneously? No indications we're giving of what is expected other than a phenomenal offer. It's very hard to negotiate against a blank wall. And I also frankly question whether USTR has the capacity to do this, or is USTR not the negotiator?
Totally agree, Jim. It's unclear to me what the game plan is. If the goal is negotiation, it's unclear to me how that plays out, who leads it, where the people to do all this at once are going to come from. Big, I think, unanswered questions, which leads me to think that in many cases, we're going to see these tariffs sustained for a period of time. Now, I do think, you know, figuring out a solution with Japan, if negotiation is the goal, then figuring out a solution with Japan will be relatively high on the priority list, I think, given the importance of the Japanese economy and the sectors involved. But we just don't know. We just don't know. This whole process has been a surprise, frankly, to pretty much everyone, right? No one that I talked to anticipated tariffs on the scale and the scope that were announced on Liberation Day. So I think there are more surprises to come.
Okay, so we just talked, I mean, when in his introduction, Jim talked about this visit by Secretary Hegseth, which seemed enormously positive and sort of highlighted Japan's extremely important status as a defense partner, as a partner in countering China, as geographically important. There was a discussion of creating a warfighting headquarters there. What do you think all of this does to, I mean, it sort of, you know, comes right on the heels of this positive defense visit. Do those two things, does one counteract the other? Can they go on kind of in parallel with not really affecting one another? What's your sense?
So great. And I think the fundamental question here is the one that you just asked, Ray, because I think there are these very disparate strands playing out at the same time. It's not yet clear to me how they come together. It's clear to me that they're being developed in their own separate silos and streams within the administration, and not clear how it comes together, if it comes together. So just to recap on the defense side and on the visit of Secretary Hegseth, I think you're exactly right. I think enormously positive visit. All the Japanese officials I talked to said that it went better than they had hoped. Signaled a lot of continuity in the bilateral agenda. If anything, an effort to accelerate things that had been previously agreed to. So force posture adjustments, deployments of new kinds of capabilities to Japan, this transformation of the headquarters that the Defense Department has in Japan, which has never been an operational, what we would call a warfighting headquarters. Previous administration had announced plans to begin to transform it to enable it to interact more effectively with Japan's new Joint Operations Command. Hegseth came in and said he wants to accelerate that. It's very much consistent with his vision of getting DOD to focus more on the warfight, right? So on the one hand, you have, if anything, a full steam ahead, accelerate the agenda visit on the defense side. And then just 2 days later, you have these sorts of things. I think we're going to see this play out in the relationship with Australia. We're going to see this play out probably in the relationship with South Korea. And the fundamental question is, can a meaningful alliance agenda, like I just described, continue and mature in the context of an economic relationship that is much more combative and much more disrupted by the administration's policy? My own view is I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that the political will be there to sustain Some of what the United States wants to do in Japan requires political will on the part of the Japanese, to include sort of access, for example, access for U.S. forces in some pretty sensitive parts of Japan. Those things become harder in an environment where the economic relationship is tense. So I think at the moment we have these things on parallel tracks moving forward together. I think at some point rather soon they begin to intersect and make progress in the alliance agenda much more complicated, I think.
Oh, I agree with you, Chris. I mean, you know from your experience as a diplomat and working foreign relations, trust is a big part of it.
Yep.
As in any relationship, if you don't trust the other party, it's very hard to make any concessions because you'll look foolish. So here Trump makes a deal a few years ago on trade. It's wiped out, not even referenced. How can you trust the United States or the Trump administration to hold?
Yep. No, I think that's exactly right, Jim.
Go ahead, Jim. Okay, so what we're seeing now is Japan trying to hedge a bit. And what I'm hearing is they're talking to South Korea and China, of all countries, about some sort of free trade area or something. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so I guess what I would say two things. First, I think you're referencing the trade ministers meeting that happened just over the last few days between Japan, South Korea, and China. Builds on a foreign ministers meeting that happened a few weeks before that. It's been kind of a reemergence of this trilateral form. We did a lot of talking about U.S.-Japan ROK, U.S.-Japan-Australia trilaterals during the Biden administration. The resurgence of this trilat is a new development. This trilat with the South Korea and China. I guess I'm not too worried about dramatic breakthroughs in the near term between Japan and China, right? There's so many difficult issues in the Japan-China relationship that stand in the way. There's the Senkaku Islands dispute, still the lingering dispute over contaminated water released from the Fukushima power plant, a whole host of other things that make the relationship difficult. But what I would say is this, you know, they weren't always successful. But the Biden administration spent a lot of time and energy on coordinating China policy with allies and partners. This was a big feature of their engagement in the region, both with the Japanese, with South Korea, with Australia, of course, even with the Europeans, right? Politically, economically, diplomatically, trying to coordinate approaches with China. If you recall the way the administration talked about China policy, they always said China policy starts with our allies. We start out, we work our way in, right? And my view is that they were at least partly successful in that effort. I think about, for example, the agreement among Japan, the Netherlands, and the United States to impose export controls on semiconductor manufacturing equipment. That was an agreement that imposed commercial cost on all three countries, right? We basically asked the Japanese to forego profits for a critical company in the Chinese market, in order to sort of maintain cooperation on export controls and technology. My concern here is that this sort of thing begins to break down. That in an environment where the U.S. is acting more unilaterally, that we're imposing, you know, these measures on allies and potential adversaries alike, you risk creating a dynamic in which everyone starts to feel like they have to pursue their own interests in the relationship with China and with others. And so I am worried that some of the hard work that was put into forging a kind of a common approach on China is going to begin to break down. Again, I don't see the Japanese have their own reasons for wanting to protect technology and trade with China. So I'm not worried about dramatic measures here, but I am worried about a dynamic in which it's a lot harder to coordinate and cooperate on China because of this new dynamic that's been created by tariffs and unilateral U.S. measures.
So, Chris, let's talk for a second about the World Trade Organization, because Japan has talked about essentially taking the U.S. to the WTO in a complaint to say that we are essentially violating WTO rules. For those of us who don't understand this world very well, let's go just sort of through it. You know, what is the WTO and what would it mean for Japan to sort of issue, get a complaint against us? And how would that affect the United States?
Yeah, the WTO, the World Trade Organization, of course, is the body that was created over the course of a series of really global negotiations over lowering trade barriers. Most of the major, basically all the major economies are a part of it. As part of being a member of the WTO, you agree to certain levels of certain standards of trade, levels of tariffs, and so on. And as part of the WTO, there's a dispute resolution mechanism where members can bring complaints against other members if they believe that some of their trade practices violate WTO commitments. So that's what the Japanese have talked about doing. Interestingly, the Chinese have also talked about bringing a WTO case against the United States. An effort by the Chinese, by the way, to portray themselves as the great upholders of the world of the global trading system, sort of an ironic thing. Look, I think the practical impact of this on the United States is low. The WTO has no enforcement capacity against the United States. Frankly, the Biden administration had already begun to walk away from many U.S. commitments to the WTO. Many of the export control and other policies that and subsidy policies that the Biden administration put in place were probably violations of WTO commitments. So, you know, I think there's we have to be sort of fair and objective about the role of the United States in the WTO. But I think what this debate in Japan reflects is a grasping for how to respond. Right. The Chinese came out today with a whole series of retaliation measures, right? New export controls, companies put on sanctions lists, areas where they're going to sort of cut off our access to some critical minerals and so on. So the Chinese are retaliating and doing so explicitly. The Japanese won't do that. But I think over time, you will see them respond in targeted ways that are probably not announced publicly. They'll find sectors where there's some vulnerability for the United States. They'll quietly impose new measures restricting trade or exports in those areas. Because I think politically they'll have to do something. And I think, you know, this debate, how to respond, is going to play out across Europeans, Canada, et cetera. So we're going to see this over and over again.
Just let me follow up on that very quickly, because I think you've drawn out something that's really kind of important in this whole discussion, which is the Prime Minister Ishida has to sort of decide how to respond. One, keeping in mind the psychology of the American administration, which reacts extremely negatively to any kind of overt response, any kind of, you know, tough response. But at the same time, coming up on an election in Japan, where if his own people don't see him responding forcefully, it's going to assume that he's a weak prime minister and has to go.
Exactly. Exactly right, Ray. I think you put your finger on it. They don't want to create an escalatory dynamic with the United States. And they know that sort of any explicit set of actions taken in response would just generate more. So they don't want to do that. But no Japanese leader can just take this without some kind of reaction. So I think it won't. The actions won't be obvious right away. They will take some time to develop. I think it's partly because the Japanese were really surprised, I think, by the scale of these tariffs. But they will respond because they have to. And then there's the question of the spillover effects in other parts of the U.S.-Japan agenda. And that's where I, you know, point to on the impact on the security side. That things where we need them to take action that requires political will, whether that's on access to U.S. forces, allowing us to bring certain kind of military capabilities into Japan, construction of a command and control relationship that might sort of, at least symbolically to the Japanese public, signal more dependence and integration with us. These things, anything that's harder, that's hard politically, will be harder as a result of this.
Are there things that wouldn't be that hard politically that would be a sop to the Trump administration, say, auto standards or buying more LNG from the U.S. or things like
that? Yeah, I do think so. I do think so, Jim. I mean, and I think Ishiba tried to do some of this when he was here, right? Signaling that he was willing to sign up for this Alaska pipeline and commit to purchases of LNG. He also put on the table a willingness to purchase some new forms of U.S. equipment. I think, you know, during the Abe years, if you look back and you look at the congressional notifications of Japanese purchases of U.S. equipment, huge spike during the Trump years. So it was clear Abe responded to Trump by buying more U.S. kit. I don't think you'll see quite as dramatic a change this time because Japanese defense spending is already increasing. There's not as much of a growth and up to a ceiling above them. But I think it's harder when, you know, the backdrop is tariffs, you know. It's hard to do both of those things at the same time. Buy more U.S. kit, but also accept these kind of trade measures. So I think this is what the Japanese are wrestling with. But there are things, I think the short answer is there are things they could do.
You talk about Japan's commitment to increase its, I believe the commitment is to double its defense spending by 2027, which is pretty ambitious. But again, going into an election, is this a line that Prime Minister Ishiba can hold to? I mean, especially when you see the drop in the stock market and you see the potential for limited growth. And of course, a limited sense of commitment to an ally who may not show as much commitment to you. How do you look at that?
Yeah. So as you say, Ray, the Japanese in 2022 committed to increase their defense spending. They said double. It's really more like 60%, depending on how, you know, if you look at the core defense budget. So there's some accounting creativity there, but it's still a very significant increase in defense spending. I mean, this is a country that had a de facto cap on defense spending of 1% of GDP for basically 30 years, right? And they are now well above that. The first 3 years of this buildup already represent more than 50% growth in Japan's defense budget in yen terms. So they're on the track that they said they would be. They've been undercut significantly by yen depreciation, which has impacted their purchases of foreign equipment and U.S. equipment in particular. They've had to move some things to the right. They've had to shrink the buy of other things. But basically, they're doing what they said they would do. I think the question on the table is what happens after 2027? And I think importantly for this conversation, is there a rebalancing toward more focus on domestic, more focus on other, say, European manufacturers of defense equipment? I mean, one example of this, right? The Japanese decision to buy Tomahawk cruise missiles, right, which was a significant decision that they announced in 2023. This was a case in which what the defense ministry wanted to do was just develop an indigenous long-range strike missile. But it was the National Security Secretariat that said, we don't trust our own industry to deliver a capability on the timeline we need it. So we're going to go to the Americans and try to buy this existing system that we know has reliability. So yeah, the National Security Secretariat overriding MOD in favor of a U.S. system. That's the kind of thing that gets a whole lot harder in this dynamic and becomes a lot easier for the domestic producers to say, we can do that. You should let us do that. Don't buy from the Americans. So that's the kind of debate I expect to play out over a whole range of things in the coming months.
So the other thing Japan has to react to is the ending of U.S. assistance to the world and to Southeast Asia and the Pacific, where Japan has been very active trying to help build infrastructure to compete with Chinese One Belt, One Road, and to keep these countries sort of on side, if you will. Now, with the increased budgetary pressures from the tariffs, from increased military spending, from distrust of the U.S., do you see that changing?
So I think this is a place where Japanese leadership has been important and is going to be even more important going forward. I mean, again, to be fair, I think there was a perception in Japan that the U.S. wasn't sufficiently focused on what they call the Global South. And, you know, in the Indo-Pacific, that means Southeast Asia and then the countries of South Asia. So this is an ongoing issue, right? The Japanese have been, as you said, Jim, leaders in development assistance, in infrastructure aid, much larger programs than the United States has had. And they've been also leaders of late on free trade, right? It was the Japanese that kept the Trans-Pacific Partnership together after the first Trump administration pulled out. So I think we're in a world where, you know, Japanese leadership in the region, both in the development sense, but also on the free trade agenda, is going to be important. I think you're going to see more focus from the Japanese on cooperating with Europe on many of these trade related issues. Of course, as I said, they're not going to. The United States will continue to be a critical partner for Japan, but I think you're going to see more unilateral leadership on their part in Asia, and then more effort to engage Europe and others on issues where kind of a global approach is needed. So I think that's what we can expect to see.
As we turn into sort of the closing part of this episode, I want to broaden out a little bit and talk about domestic Japanese politics a little bit and just help orient our listeners to who is the opposition for Prime Minister Ishiba and the LDP in this upcoming election?
Yeah, as I said before, Ishiba leads a minority government in Japan, which means that no party has a majority. His LDP, his Liberal Democratic Party, still has a majority in the upper house, but does not in the lower house. And so they've had to cooperate with a couple of different minority parties in order to attain the majority required to pass the budget, to pass other forms of legislation. The Ishiba government has been relatively successful at doing that. They had a more contentious budget process than is usually the case, but they just successfully passed a budget more or less on time for the start of the fiscal year. They have other important legislative items on the agenda. A big one that's coming up is a cybersecurity law that would significantly enhance Japan's cybersecurity infrastructure. This has been a priority for the United States for some time because it's sort of a foundational thing for our alliance cooperation. But for Ishiba, he's been successful in moving legislation forward, but it's slow, takes more time than normal. It's just a sort of a cumbersome dynamic. I think, you know, this is an upper house election, really, that's coming in July. The lower house is really the most powerful body, and so is the most important thing to watch. But it's possible that a broader realignment in Japanese politics is coming. There is some of these opposition parties. The Democratic Party for the People has a leader with some public appeal. There's frustration with the LDP. So it's possible that a broader realignment of Japanese politics is coming and that a non-LDP leader will prevail in the next cycle. But it's too early, a little too early to say. But I guess the point I would make here is that what's happened in the relationship with these tariffs is a significant external shock that will have political impact. We don't yet know the full extent of that impact, but one result could be it contributes to this political realignment that's possible.
Well, this realignment externally could include doing more with India, Australia, Europe, as you mentioned. You think there's a move to actually, all right, the U.S. wants to be an autocracy, all right, you're on your own, and they create a more global RCEP or TPP to include more countries. Is that a path?
Possibly over time, Jim. I think, you know, it's still early days in all of this. But, I mean, the Japanese have been frustrated for some time with U.S. trade and economic policy, right? In every meeting that I was a part of during the Biden administration, including meetings with the president, the Japanese would say, please come back to CPTPP. And of course,
progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of the successor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership that took shape under Abe. And of course, the Biden administration never did. The Trump administration certainly won't. So this has been building, right? And I think to go back to my China point, there is now, I think, building pressure on the Japanese and others in the region to think about other architectures that don't include the United States. Maybe there is more of a focus on RCEP. Maybe there is more of a focus on the Japan ROK China grouping. So I think the reality that U.S. economic leadership is not going to be there for the foreseeable future is taking hold and will lead to consideration of other structures, and that ultimately, you know, that leave the United States out.
And does Japan see itself potentially, or does the leadership in Japan see itself potentially as a leader of this post-U.S. or these post-U.S. structures?
Again, too early to say. But I think what you will see is, if you think about the Biden administration, the focus on the U.S.-Japan ROK trilateral, the U.S.-Japan-Australia trilateral, the engagement with the Philippines, a lot of this was driven first by the United States. I think you will see the Japanese with a more active agenda of their own, focused on Australia, focused on South Korea, I think. Certainly focused on the Philippines. We already see that. Ishiba visiting the Philippines. focused on India. I do think that, I mean, this is going to be a long process, right? There is nothing that would begin to approach replacing the alliance with the United States. And the Japanese will hold on to that as their anchor for now, but they will, I think, accelerate their efforts to diversify relationships, including security partnerships.
Now, maybe one last question, that even though you weren't a Treasury guy, Japan has huge holdings, is a big buyer of U.S. Treasury bills and bonds. Is there a risk that they'll stop buying it?
Good question, Jim. Not an area that I'm expert in. I tend to think, again, in the near term, I wouldn't place a high risk on that. Remember, Japanese bonds return less than 1%. So U.S. Treasuries look quite attractive in comparison. So I don't see a flight from U.S. Treasuries happening anytime soon. We're 2 days into this, and how far down is the stock market? I guess what I would just say is we've had a significant shock to the global economy over the last 2 days. And I think it's too early to really assess the effects. But if this policy continues, the effects are going to be pretty profound.
All right, Chris Johnstone, we know you've got to run. I'm sure, we're going to try to get this one out pretty quickly, because I'm sure nothing else will happen
right.
In a couple of days.
You got to do it quickly.
So, but we're going to get this out pretty fast. If people want to keep track of you, since you keep moving around, where can they keep track of your work?
I'm at the Asia Group, where I'm a partner in the defense practice. I still do work with CSIS. And you can always follow me on Twitter as well, although I don't do quite as much on that. LinkedIn is probably the better place.
All right.
Yeah, LinkedIn.
All right, Chris John. So thanks very much. And thanks for taking time out of your busy day. Thanks for coming back.
Very good. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
And of course, our sponsor is Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. Of course, if you want advice on what you should do if you're trying to do business in Japan in this new era, you're certainly going to need a guide. Bauer Group Asia is a great guide. Jim Caruso, my co-host, is a senior advisor with Bauer Group, and you can certainly visit their website and learn more at bauergroupasia.com. Jim, we are, as we said, 2 days in after Liberation Day, and the shock waves are still going out. Chris Johnstone seems remarkably calm.
He did, but he said several times it's a shock to the global system. Yeah, and how it plays out is important, and we don't know how it's going to play out. But Trump said today, I'm not changing. Then he says, I'll take a deal. So as usual, no one knows. But people are voting with their money, with the Dow Jones down 2,000 today, 1,000 yesterday. These are huge moves with trillions of dollars wiped off of our market capitalization. So if you're Japan or any other of our allies who've done business with us over the years, who have trade agreements with us, who have huge investments in the U.S., and now it's all thrown up in the air without even a discussion, without saying, you know, that's what I find so frustrating. If he went to Japan and said, look, we need to fix this, negotiations could be done. But what's the law?
I mean, I think, you know, that's part of the, I think in the president's mind and in the mind of many of his people, this is just its own separate little thing, right? That we're going to do this thing, and we're doing it in the blanket way over everybody, and nobody should worry about it, you know, and it shouldn't have any effect whatsoever on every other thing that we do, right? So Secretary Hegseth's trip to Japan is like its own completely different thing, and the two don't really connect.
Well, it's like, okay, I'm sleeping with your wife, but we can still be business partners, right?
Wait, what?
it's so outrageous.
Yeah. So that, and of course, the other thing about these particular tariffs is that they seem to have been developed by children. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't normally go there, but you know, the math is just this weird math that, you know, takes the, you know, this is the trade deficit, and then we're going to divide by this, and you know, and it doesn't see it, and of course, it seems to have also been delivered in a way that's just amateur hour. You know, we segregate out these islands that don't have any people on them, and they get a 10% tariff because reasons. I mean, and that it makes it very hard for people to take sort of the whole thing seriously. But of course, you have to take it seriously because it's a huge tariff on your country.
So I visited Norfolk Island, which has twice the tariffs that Australia does, even though Norfolk Island is part of Australia. They don't sell anything to us. They don't make anything, but they celebrate Thanksgiving because Yankee whalers stop there in the day and deposited our tradition. So they're a little confused.
Yeah. Well, I normally look for the benefit of the doubt. I am really, I mean, so here's my best guess. And of course, you know, we've seen even this morning, there's been news come out that that Tô Lâm from Vietnam has tried to has got in touch with President Trump, and they're talking about making a deal. And maybe that's the idea, right? You throw down on everybody and you watch everybody line up at your door to make a better deal, right? And so again, maybe this is the art of the deal. But of course, that's the other thing about this is there have been so many different messages coming out of DC about what the purpose is of tariffs. it's a bargaining chip, or it's the way that we're going to fill the coffers and replace the income tax, or it's the way that we get manufacturing, or it's everything all at once.
Don't forget petrol and illegal immigrants as well.
It's a floor cleaner and a dessert topping, right? It's everything. Sorry, that's an old Saturday Night Live.
I understood it.
Okay. Like,
yeah. All right, let's get out of here on a happy note. Tell me a story that makes me happy.
All right, let me tell you a Japan story. So I was stationed in Okinawa, which of course is a southern island in the Japanese archipelago. My wife and I and my infant son went on a little trip up to Tokyo just for fun. And while I was up there with a friend of mine, we decided that we would climb Mount Fuji. So we had not done this before. We did a little bit of research. This was before the age of the internet. So we had to go find these things called books. I noticed you have a number of them behind you on your museum wall back there. So I had to go look up, you know, what does one do when one climbs Mount Fuji? And so we went to this thing called Fifth Station, which is basically where the big parking lot and all of the gift shops are. And you can stay the night there in the hotels. And so we get to Fifth Station, and basically that's where the mountain starts to turn into an actual mountain. It's not just sort of a long upward slope. And so we took the bus to Fifth Station. We got off, we bought our Fuji sticks, which is what you get at the gift shop because that's where they get your money. And we start hiking along the path, and we're walking along. And the way that you do sort of Mount Fuji in the way that a lot of people do it is you hike at night. So you want to get to the summit when the sun comes up and you watch the sunrise. So we're hiking at night, and we are following this little group of about four elderly Japanese women. And they have the lights on their heads. We've got the flashlights in our hands. They've got the lights on their heads. So, you know, with a strap. And so at a certain point, they take a right turn and begin to go up this steep slope. And we thought, well, is that the way you go? Well, of course, they're elderly Japanese women with lights on their heads. They must know the way to the top of Mount Fuji. So we followed them. And for the next hour, we were sort of climbing up this steep shale slope, you know, slipping and sliding and getting in, you know, our hands, having to use our hands to move up. And we're beginning to think, like, this is miserable. I mean, we're going to have to do this all night. And of course, an hour later, we clear the lip of some little ledge, and there's the path, right? Going from left to right, and people are walking along and looking at these four elderly Japanese women with lights on their heads, and these two young American guys sort of climb over the side of this ledge. So, you know, the moral of the story is, just because you're in Japan and you're an elderly Japanese woman with a light on your head doesn't mean you know how to climb Mount Fuji.
I've always thought of you as an elderly Japanese woman, but now I understand.
Well, no, that's who you're following.
Either way.
So, well, you know, of course, the saying in Japan is that a wise man climbs Mount Fuji and a fool climbs it a second time. So you'll be glad to know I have in fact climbed it twice.
I'd expect nothing less.
All right. One man who is not a fool, of course, is our producer, Ian Ellis Jones. You'll want to follow him and IEJ Media, his production company, or his graphics company, to get their great military and geopolitical graphics. Follow him on X at Ian Ellis Jones, as everybody else does. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and follow. If you are following us on YouTube, it's youtube.com/IP Podcast. And you can go back and you can watch, say, the episode with Ambassador Shingo Yamagami, which was "Why Should We Care About China's Wolf Warrior Diplomats?" That was episode 17. That was a great one, where I asked him specifically at the end if he had climbed Mount Fuji, and I was disappointed to find out that he hadn't. So apparently, I'm a fool, but he is not a wise man. All right. You can also, of course, follow us or listen to us on the audio podcasts, which is the way I do it. So that's an Apple Podcast, that's on Spotify, that's on Amazon, that's on all of them. And you can follow us on social media. We've got pages on LinkedIn or Blue Sky. You just look for our name. You can go to X, we're IndoPac Podcast. And then if you want to email us, it's indopacificpodcast@gmail.com. Once more, we want to thank our great sponsors, Bauer Group Asia. Visit them to learn how to navigate the world's most complex markets like Japan. And you can find them at bauergroupasia.com. That's it for this time. For Ian and Jim, I'm Ray. Until next time, please join us again at Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific.